Chapter 55. Legend proclaims that it is physically impossible upon entering the baptistry of San Giovanni not to look up. Langdon, despite having been in this room many times, now felt the mystical pull of the space and let his gaze climb skyward to the ceiling. High, high overhead, the surface of the baptistry's octagonal vault spanned more than 80 feet from side to side. It glistened and shimmered as if it were made of smoldering coals. Its burnished amber-gold surface reflected the ambient light unevenly from more than 1 million smalty tiles. Tiny, ungrouted mosaic pieces hand-cut from a glassy silica glaze, which were arranged in 6 concentric rings in which scenes from the Bible were depicted. Adding stark drama to the lustrous upper portion of the room, natural light pierced the dark space through a central oculus, much like the one in Rome's Pantheon, assisted by a series of high, small, deeply recessed windows that threw shafts of illumination that were so focused and tight that they seemed almost solid, like structural beams propped at ever-changing angles. As Langdon walked with Sienna deeper into the room, he took in the legendary ceiling mosaic, a multi-tiered representation of heaven and hell, very much like the depiction in the Divine Comedy. Dante Alighieri saw this as a child, Langdon thought. Inspiration from above. Langdon fixed his gaze now on the centerpiece of the mosaic. Hovering directly above the main altar rose a 27-foot-tall Jesus Christ, seated in judgment over the saved and the damned. At Jesus' right hand, the righteous received the reward of everlasting life. On his left hand, however, the sinful were stoned, roasted on spikes, and eaten by all manner of creatures. Overseeing the torture was a colossal mosaic of Satan portrayed as an infernal, man-eating beast. Langdon always flinched when he saw this figure, which more than 700 years ago had stared down at the young Dante Alighieri, terrifying him, and eventually inspiring his vivid portrayal of what lurked in the final ring of hell. The frightening mosaic overhead depicted a horned devil that was in the process of consuming a human being head first. The victim's legs dangled from Satan's mouth in a way that resembled the flailing legs of the half-buried sinners in Dante's Malebolge. L'imperador del doloroso regno, Langdon thought, recalling Dante's text, the emperor of the despondent kingdom. Slithering from the ears of Satan were 2 massive, writhing snakes also in the process of consuming sinners, giving the impression that Satan had 3 heads, exactly as Dante described him in the final canto of his Inferno. Langdon searched his memory and recalled fragments of Dante's imagery. On his head he had 3 faces, his 3 chins gushing a bloody froth, his 3 mouths used as grinders, gnashing sinners 3 at once. That Satan's evil was threefold, Langdon knew, was fraught with symbolic meaning. It placed him in perfect balance with the threefold glory of the Holy Trinity. As Langdon stared up at the horrific sight, he tried to imagine the effect the mosaic had on the youthful Dante, who had attended services at this church year after year, and seen Satan staring down at him each time he prayed. This morning, however, Langdon had the uneasy feeling that the devil was staring directly at him. He quickly lowered his gaze to the baptistry's second-story balcony and standing gallery, the lone area from which women were permitted to view baptisms, and then down to the suspended tomb of Antipope John the 23rd, his body lying in repose high on the wall, like a cave dweller or a subject in a magician's levitation trick. Finally, his gaze reached the ornately tiled floor, which many believed contained references to medieval astronomy. He let his eyes move across the intricate black and white patterns until they reached the very center of the room. And there it is, he thought, knowing he was staring at the exact spot where Dante Alighieri had been baptized in the latter half of the 13th century. I shall return as poet at my baptismal font, Langdon declared, his voice echoing through the empty space. This is it. Sienna looked troubled as she eyed the center of the floor where Langdon was now pointing.
But there's nothing here.
Not anymore, Langdon replied. All that remained was a large, reddish-brown octagon of pavement. This unusually plain, eight-sided area clearly interrupted the pattern of the more ornately designed floor, and resembled nothing so much as a large, patched-up hole, which, in fact, was precisely what it was. Langdon quickly explained that the baptistry's original baptismal font had been a large octagonal pool located at the very center of this room. While modern fonts were usually raised basins, earlier fonts were more akin to the literal meaning of the word font, springs or fountains, in this case a deep pool of water into which participants could be more deeply immersed. Langdon wondered what this stone chamber had sounded like as children screamed in fear while being literally submerged in the large pool of icy water that once stood in the middle of the floor. Baptisms here were cold and scary, Langdon said. True rites of passage. Dangerous, even. Allegedly, Dante once jumped into the font to save a drowning child. In any case, the original font was covered over at some point in the 16th century. Sienna's eyes now began darting around the building with obvious concern.
But if Dante's baptismal font is gone, where did Ignazio hide the mask?
Langdon understood her alarm. There was no shortage of hiding places in this massive chamber, behind columns, statues, tombs, inside niches, at the altar, even upstairs. Nonetheless, Langdon felt remarkably confident as he turned and faced the door through which they'd just entered. "We should start over there," he said, pointing to an area against the wall just to the right of the gates of Paradise. On a raised platform behind a decorative gate, there sat a tall hexagonal plinth of carved marble, which resembled a small altar or service table. The exterior was so intricately carved that it resembled a mother-of-pearl cameo. Atop the marble base sat a polished wooden top with a diameter of about 3 feet. Sienna looked uncertain as she followed Langdon over to it. As they ascended the steps and moved inside the protective gate, Sienna looked more closely and drew a startled breath, realizing what she was looking at. Langdon smiled. "Exactly. It's not an altar or table." The polished wooden top was, in fact, a lid, a covering for the hollow structure.
"A baptismal font?" she asked.
Langdon nodded. "If Dante were baptized today, it would be in this basin right here." Wasting no time, he took a deep, purposeful breath and placed his palms on the wooden cover, feeling a tingle of anticipation as he prepared to remove it. Langdon tightly gripped the edges of the cover and heaved it to one side, carefully sliding the top off the marble base, placing it on the floor beside the font. Then he peered down into the 2-foot-wide, dark, hollow space within. The eerie sight made Langdon swallow hard. From out of the shadows, the dead face of Dante Alighieri was looking back at him. Chapter 56. Seek and ye shall find. Langdon stood at the rim of the baptismal font and stared down at the pale yellow death mask, whose wrinkled countenance gazed blankly upward. The hooked nose and protruding chin were unmistakable. Dante Alighieri. The lifeless face was disturbing enough, and yet something about its position in the font seemed almost supernatural. For a moment, Langdon was unsure what he was seeing. Is the mask hovering? Langdon crouched lower, peering more closely at the scene before him. The font was several feet deep, more of a vertical well than a shallow basin, its steep walls dropping down to a hexagonal repository that was filled with water. Strangely, the mask seemed to be suspended partway down the font, perched just above the surface of the water as if by magic. It took a moment for Langdon to realize what was causing the illusion. The font had a vertical central spindle that rose halfway up and flattened into a kind of small metal platter just above the water. The platter appeared to be a decorative fountainhead and perhaps a place to rest a baby's bottom, but it was currently serving as a pedestal on which the mask of Dante rested, elevated safely above the water. Neither Langdon nor Sienna said a word as they stood side by side gazing down at the craggy face of Dante Alighieri, still sealed in his Ziploc bag, as if he'd been suffocated. For a moment, the image of a face staring up out of a water-filled basin conjured for Langdon his own terrifying experience as a child, stuck at the bottom of a well, staring skyward in desperation. Pushing the thought from his mind, he carefully reached down and gripped the mask onto either side, where Dante's ears would have been. Although the face was small by modern standards, the ancient plaster was heavier than he'd expected. He slowly lifted the mask out of the font and held it up so that he and Sienna could examine it more closely. Even viewed through the plastic bag, the mask was remarkably lifelike. Every wrinkle and blemish of the old poet's face had been captured by the wet plaster. With the exception of an old crack down the center of the mask, it was in perfect condition.
"Turn it over," Sienna whispered. "Let's see the back."
Langdon was already doing just that. The security video from the Palazzo Vecchio had clearly shown Langdon and Ignazio discovering something on the reverse side of the mask, something of such startling interest that the two men had essentially walked out of the palace with the artifact. Taking exceptional care not to drop the fragile plaster, Langdon flipped the mask over and laid it face down in his right palm so they could examine the back. Unlike the weathered, textured face of Dante, the inside of the mask was smooth and bare. Because the mask was never meant to be worn, its backside had been filled in with plaster to give some solidity to the delicate piece, resulting in a featureless, concave surface, like a shallow soup bowl. Langdon didn't know what he had expected to find on the back of the mask, but it most certainly was not this. Nothing. Nothing at all. Just a smooth, empty surface. Sienna seemed equally confused.
"It's blank plaster," she whispered. "If there's nothing here, what did you and Ignazio see?"
"I have no idea," Langdon thought, pulling the plastic bag taut across the plaster for a clearer view.
"There's nothing here."
With mounting distress, Langdon raised the mask into a shaft of light and studied it closely. As he tipped the object over for a better view, he thought for an instant that he might have glimpsed a faint discoloration near the top, a line of markings running horizontally across the inside of Dante's forehead. A natural blemish? Or maybe something else? Langdon immediately spun and pointed to a hinged panel of marble on the wall behind them.
"Look in there," he told Sienna. "See if there are towels."
Sienna looked skeptical but obeyed, opening the discreetly hidden cupboard, which contained three items: a valve for controlling the water level in the font, a light switch for controlling the spotlight above the font, and a stack of linen towels. She gave Langdon a surprised look, but Langdon had toured enough churches worldwide to know that baptismal fonts almost always afforded their priests easy access to emergency swaddling cloths. The unpredictability of infants' bladders a universal risk of christenings.
"Good," he said, eyeing the towels. "Hold the mask a second."
He gently transferred the mask to Sienna's hands and then set to work. First, Langdon retrieved the hexagonal lid and heaved it back up onto the font to restore the small altar-like table they had first seen. Then he grabbed several of the linen towels from the cupboard and spread them out like a tablecloth. Finally, he flipped the font's light switch, and the spotlight directly overhead sprang to life, illuminating the baptismal area and shining brightly down on the covered surface. Sienna gently laid the mask on the font, while Langdon retrieved more towels, which he used like oven mitts to slide the mask from the Ziploc bag, careful not to touch it with his bare hands. Moments later, Dante's death mask lay unsheathed and naked, face up beneath the bright light, like the head of an anesthetized patient on an operating table. The mask's dramatic texturing appeared even more unsettling in the light, the creases and wrinkles of old age accentuated by the discolored plaster. Langdon wasted no time using his makeshift mitts to flip the mask over and lay it face down. The backside of the mask looked markedly less aged than the front, clean and white rather than dingy and yellow. Sienna cocked her head, looking puzzled.
"Does this side look newer to you?"
Admittedly, the color difference was more emphatic than Langdon would have imagined, but this side was most certainly the same age as the front. "Uneven aging," he said. "The back of the mask has been shielded by the display case, so has never suffered the aging effects of sunlight." Langdon made a mental note to double the SPF of his sunscreen.
Hold on,
Sienna said, leaning in close to the mask.
Look, on the forehead. That must be what you and Ignacio saw.
Langdon's eyes moved quickly across the smooth white surface to the same discoloration he had spied earlier through the plastic, a faint line of markings that ran horizontally across the inside of Dante's forehead. Now, however, in the stark light, Langdon saw clearly that these markings were not a natural blemish. They were man-made.
It's writing,
Sienna whispered, the words catching in her throat.
But
Langdon studied the inscription on the plaster. It was a single row of letters, handwritten in a florid script of faint brownish yellow.
That's all it says?
Sienna said, sounding almost angry. Langdon barely heard her. Who wrote this? He wondered. Someone in Dante's era? It seemed unlikely. If so, some art historian would have spotted it long ago during regular cleaning or restoration, and the writing would have become part of the lore of the mask. Langdon had never heard of it. A far more likely source quickly materialized in his mind. Bertrand Zobrist. Zobrist was the mask's owner and therefore could easily have requested private access to it whenever he wanted. He could have written the text on the back of the mask fairly recently and then replaced it in the antique case without anyone ever knowing. The mask's owner, Marta had told them, won't even permit our staff to open the case without him present. Langdon quickly explained his theory. Sienna seemed to accept his logic, and yet the prospect clearly troubled her.
It makes no sense, she said, looking restless. If we believe Zobrist secretly wrote something on the back of the Dante death mask, and he also went to the trouble to create that little projector to point to the mask, then why didn't he write something more meaningful? I mean, it's senseless. You and I have been looking all day for the mask, and this is all we find?
Langdon redirected his focus to the text on the back of the mask. The handwritten message was very brief, only 7 letters long, and admittedly looked entirely purposeless. Sienna's frustration is certainly understandable. Langdon, however, felt the familiar thrill of imminent revelation, having realized almost instantly that these 7 letters would tell him everything he needed to know about what he and Sienna were to do next. Furthermore, he had detected a faint odor to the mask, a familiar scent that divulged why the plaster on the back was so much whiter than the front, and the difference had nothing to do with aging or sunlight.
I don't understand, Sienna said. The letters are all the same.
Langdon nodded calmly as he studied the line of text. 7 identical letters carefully inscribed in calligraphy across the inside of Dante's forehead. P, 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 P.
7 P's, Sienna said. What are we supposed to do with this?
Langdon smiled calmly and raised his eyes to hers. I suggest we do precisely what this message tells us to do. Sienna stared.
7 P's is a message?
It is, he said with a grin. And if you've studied Dante, it's a very clear one. Outside the baptistry of San Giovanni, the man with the necktie wiped his fingernails on his handkerchief and dabbed at the pustules on his neck. He tried to ignore the burning in his eyes as he squinted at his destination, the tourist entrance. Outside the door, a wearied docent in a blazer smoked a cigarette and redirected tourists who apparently couldn't decipher the building's schedule, which was written in international time. Apertura, 1300 to 1700 hours. The man with the rash checked his watch. It was 10:02 a.m. The baptistry was closed for another few hours. He watched the docent for a while and then made up his mind. He removed the gold stud from his ear and pocketed it. Then he pulled out his wallet and checked its contents. In addition to assorted credit cards and a wad of euros, he was carrying over $3,000 in cash. Thankfully, avarice was an international sin. Chapter 57. Peccatum, peccatum, peccatum. The seven P's written on the back of Dante's death mask immediately pulled Langdon's thoughts back into the text of the Divine Comedy. For a moment, he was back on stage in Vienna, presenting his lecture, Divine Dante, Symbols of Hell. "We have now descended," his voice resounded over the speakers, "passing down through the nine rings of hell to the center of the earth, coming face to face with Satan himself." Langdon moved from slide to slide through a series of three-headed Satans from various works of art, Botticelli's Mappa, the Florence Baptistry's Mosaic, and Andrea di Cioni's terrifying black demon, its fur soiled with the crimson blood of its victims. "Together," Langdon continued, "we have climbed down the shaggy chest of Satan, reversed direction as gravity shifted, and emerged from the gloomy underworld once again to see the stars." Langdon advanced slides until he reached an image he had shown earlier, the iconic Domenico di Michelino painting from inside the Duomo, which depicted the red-robed Dante standing outside the walls of Florence. "And if you look carefully, you will see those stars." Langdon pointed to the star-filled sky that arched above Dante's head. "As you see, the heavens are constructed in a series of nine concentric spheres around the earth. This nine-tiered structure of paradise is intended to reflect and balance the nine rings of the underworld. As you've probably noticed, the number nine is a recurring theme for Dante." Langdon paused, taking a sip of water and letting the crowd catch their breath after their harrowing descent and final exit from hell. "So, after enduring the horrors of the Inferno, you must all be very excited to move toward paradise. Unfortunately, in the world of Dante, nothing is ever simple." He heaved a dramatic sigh. "To ascend to paradise, we all must, both figuratively and literally, climb a mountain." Langdon pointed to the Michelino painting. On the horizon, behind Dante, the audience could see a single cone-shaped mountain rising into the heavens. Spiraling up the mountain, a pathway circled the cone repeatedly, nine times, ascending in ever-tightening terraces toward the top. Along the pathway, naked figures trudged upward in misery, enduring various penances on the way. "I give you Mount Purgatory," Langdon announced. "And sadly, this grueling nine-ring descent is the only route from the depths of Inferno to the glory of Paradise. On this path, you can see the repentant souls ascending, each paying an appropriate price for a given sin. The envious must climb with their eyes sewn shut, so they cannot covet. The prideful must carry huge stones on their backs to bend them low in a humble manner. The gluttonous must climb without food or water, thereby suffering excruciating hunger, and the lustful must ascend through hot flames to purge themselves of passion's heat." He paused. "But before you are permitted the great privilege of climbing this mountain and purging your sins, you must speak to this individual." Langdon switched slides to a close-up of the Michelino painting, wherein a winged angel sat on a throne at the foot of Mount Purgatory. At the angel's feet, a line of penitent sinners awaited admittance to the upward path. Strangely, the angel was wielding a long sword, the point of which he seemed to be stabbing into the face of the first person in line. "Who knows," Langdon called out, "what this angel is doing?" "Stabbing someone in the head?" a voice ventured. "Nope." Another voice. "Stabbing someone in the eye?" Langdon shook his head. "Anyone else?" A voice way in the back spoke firmly. "Writing on his forehead." Langdon smiled. "It appears someone back there knows his Dante." He motioned again to the painting. "I realize it looks like the angel is stabbing this poor fellow in the forehead, but he is not. According to Dante's text, the angel who guards Purgatory uses the tip of his sword to write something on his visitors' foreheads before they enter." "And what does he write, you ask?" Langdon paused for effect. "Strangely, he writes a single letter, which is repeated seven times. Does anyone know what letter the angel writes seven times on Dante's forehead?" "P!" shouted a voice in the crowd. Langdon smiled. "Yes, the letter P. This P signifies peccatum, the Latin word for sin, and the fact that it is written seven times is symbolic of the septem peccata mortalia, also known as the seven deadly sins, someone else shouted. Bingo. And so, only by ascending through each level of purgatory can you atone for your sins. With each new level that you ascend, an angel cleanses one of the peas from your forehead until you reach the top, arriving with your brow cleansed of the seven peas and your soul purged of all sin. He winked. The place is called purgatory for a reason. Langdon emerged from his thoughts to see Sienna staring at him over the baptismal font.
The seven peas? She said, pulling him back to the present and motioning down to Dante's death mask. You say it's a message? Telling us what to do?
Langdon quickly explained Dante's vision of Mount Purgatory, the peas representing the seven deadly sins, and the process of cleansing them from the forehead. Obviously, Langdon concluded, Bertrand Zobrist, as the Dante fanatic that he was, would be familiar with the seven peas and the process of cleansing them from the forehead as a means of moving forward toward paradise. Sienna looked doubtful.
You think Bertrand Zobrist put those peas on the mask because he wants us to literally wipe them off the death mask? That's what you think we're supposed to do?
I realize it's...
Robert, even if we wipe off the letters, how does that help us? We'll just end up with a totally blank mask.
Maybe. Langdon offered a hopeful grin. Maybe not. I think there's more there than meets the eye. He motioned down to the mask. Remember how I told you that the back of the mask was lighter in color because of uneven aging?
Yes.
I may have been wrong, he said. The color difference seems too stark to be aging, and the texture of the back has teeth.
Teeth?
Langdon showed her that the texture on the back was far rougher than that of the front, and also far grittier, like sandpaper. In the art world, this rough texture is called teeth, and painters prefer to paint on a surface that has teeth because the paint sticks to it better.
I'm not following.
Langdon smiled. Do you know what gesso is?
Sure. Painters use it to prime canvases and...
She stopped short, his meaning apparently registering. Exactly, Langdon said. They use gesso to create a clean, white, toothy surface, and sometimes to cover up unwanted paintings if they want to reuse a canvas. Now Sienna looked excited.
And you think maybe Zobrist covered the back of the death mask with gesso?
It would explain the teeth and the lighter color. It also might explain why he would want us to wipe off the seven peas. Sienna looked puzzled by this last point. Smell this. Langdon said, raising the mask to her face like a priest offering communion. Sienna cringed.
Gesso smells like a wet dog?
Not all gesso. Regular gesso smells like chalk. Wet dog is acrylic gesso.
Meaning?
Meaning it's water-soluble. Sienna cocked her head, and Langdon could sense the wheels turning. She shifted her gaze slowly to the mask, and then suddenly back to Langdon, her eyes wide.
You think there's something under the gesso?
It would explain a lot. Sienna immediately gripped the hexagonal wooden font covering and rotated it part way off, exposing the water below. She grabbed a fresh linen towel and plunged it into the baptismal water. Then she held out the dripping cloth for Langdon.
You should do it.
Langdon placed the mask face down in his left palm, and took the wet linen. Shaking out the excess water, he began dabbing the damp cloth on the inside of Dante's forehead, moistening the area with the seven calligraphic peas. After several dabs with his index finger, he re-dipped the cloth in the font and continued. The black ink began smearing. The gesso is dissolving, he said excitedly. The ink is coming off with it. As he performed the process a third time, Langdon began speaking in a pious and somber monotone, which resonated in the baptistry. Through baptism, the Lord Jesus Christ has freed you from sin and brought you to new life through water and the Holy Spirit. Sienna stared at Langdon like he'd lost his mind. He shrugged. It seemed appropriate. She rolled her eyes and turned back to the mask. As Langdon continued applying water, the original plaster beneath the gesso became visible, its yellowish hue more in keeping with what Langdon would have expected from an artifact this old. When the last of the peas had disappeared, he dried the area with a clean linen and held the mask up for Sienna to observe. She gasped out loud. Precisely as Langdon had anticipated, there was indeed something hidden beneath the gesso, a second layer of calligraphy. 9 letters, written directly onto the pale yellow surface of the original plaster. This time, however, the letters formed a word. Chapter 58.
Possessed? Sienna demanded. I don't understand.
I'm not sure I do either. Langdon studied the text that had materialized beneath the 7 P's, a single word emblazoned across the inside of Dante's forehead. Possessed.
As in, possessed by the devil?
Sienna asked. Possibly.
Langdon turned his gaze overhead to the mosaic of Satan consuming the wretched souls who had never been able to purge themselves of sin.
Dante possessed? It didn't seem to make much sense.
There's got to be more,
Sienna contended, taking the mask from Langdon's hands and studying it more closely. After a moment, she began nodding.
Yes. Look at the ends of the word. There's more text on either side.
Langdon looked again, now seeing the faint shadow of additional text showing through the moist gesso at either end of the word possessed. Eagerly, Sienna grabbed the cloth and continued dabbing around the word until more text materialized, written on a gentle curve. O you possessed of sturdy intellect. Langdon let out a low whistle. O you possessed of sturdy intellect, observe the teachings hidden here, beneath the veil of verses so obscure. Sienna stared at him.
I'm sorry?
It's taken from one of the most famous stanzas of Dante's Inferno, Langdon said excitedly. It's Dante urging his smartest readers to seek the wisdom hidden within his cryptic verse. Langdon often cited this exact line when teaching literary symbolism. The line was as close an example as existed to an author waving his arms wildly and shouting, Hey, readers! There's a symbolic double meaning here. Sienna began rubbing the back of the mask, more vigorously now. Careful with that, Langdon urged.
You're right, Sienna announced, zealously wiping away gesso. The rest of Dante's quote is here, just as you recalled it.
She paused to dip the cloth back in the font and rinse it out. Langdon looked on in dismay as the water in the baptismal font turned cloudy with dissolved gesso. Our apologies to San Giovanni, he thought, uneasy that this sacred font was being used as a sink. When Sienna raised the cloth from the water, it was dripping. She barely wrung it out before placing the soggy cloth in the center of the mask and swishing it around as if she were cleaning a soup bowl.
Sienna, Langdon admonished, that's an ancient... The whole backside has text, she announced as she scoured the inside of the mask. And it's written in...
She paused, cocking her head to the left and rotating the mask to the right, as if trying to read sideways.
Written in what? Langdon demanded, unable to see.
Sienna finished cleaning the mask and dried it off with a fresh cloth. Then she set it down in front of him so they could both study the result. When Langdon saw the inside of the mask, he did a double take. The entire concave surface was covered in text, what had to be nearly 100 words. Beginning at the top with the line, O you possessed of sturdy intellect, the text continued in a single, unbroken line, curling down the right side of the mask to the bottom, where it turned upside down, and continued back across the bottom, returning up the left side of the mask to the beginning, where it repeated a similar path in a slightly smaller loop. The path of the text was eerily reminiscent of Mount Purgatory's spiraling pathway to paradise. The symbologist in Langdon instantly identified the precise spiral. Symmetrical clockwise Archimedean. He had also noted that the number of revolutions from the first word, O, to the final period in the center, was a familiar number. 9. Barely breathing, Langdon turned the mask in slow circles, reading the text as it curled ever inward around the concave bowl, funneling toward the center.
O you possessed of sturdy intellect, observe the teaching that is hidden here. Beneath the veil of verses so obscure, seek the treacherous Doge of Venice, who severed the heads from horses, and plucked up the bones of the blind. Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom, and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here in the darkness the thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars.
The first stanza is Dante almost verbatim, Langdon said. O you possessed of sturdy intellect, observe the teaching that is hidden here, beneath the veil of verses so obscure.
And the rest? Sienna pressed.
Langdon shook his head. I don't think so. It's written in a similar verse pattern, but I don't recognize the text as Dante's.
It looks like someone is imitating his style.
Sobrist, Sienna whispered. It has to be.
Langdon nodded. It was as good a guess as any. Zobrist, after all, by altering Botticelli's Mappa dell'Inferno, had already revealed his proclivity for collaborating with the masters and modifying great works of art to suit his needs. The rest of the text is very strange, Langdon said again, rotating the mask and reading inward. It talks about severing the heads from horses, plucking up the bones of the blind. He skimmed ahead to the final line, which was written in a tight circle at the very center of the mask. He drew a startled breath. It also mentions blood-red waters. Sienna's eyebrows arched.
Just like your visions of the silver-haired woman?
Langdon nodded, puzzling over the text. The blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars?
Look, she whispered, reading over his shoulder and pointing to a single word partway through the spiral. A specific location.
Langdon's eyes found the word, which he had skimmed over on his first pass. It was the name of one of the most spectacular and unique cities in the world. Langdon felt a chill, knowing it also happened to be the city in which Dante Alighieri famously became infected with the deadly disease that killed him. Venice. Langdon and Sienna studied the cryptic verses in silence for several moments. The poem was disturbing and macabre, and hard to decipher. Use of the words Doge and Lagoon confirmed for Langdon beyond any doubt that the poem was indeed referencing Venice, a unique Italian water-world city made up of hundreds of interconnected lagoons and ruled for centuries by a Venetian head of state known as a Doge. At a glance, Langdon could not discern exactly where in Venice this poem was pointing, but it definitely seemed to be urging the reader to follow its directions. Place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water.
It's pointing underground, Sienna said, reading along with him.
Langdon gave an uneasy nod as he read the next line.
Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here in the darkness the thonic monster waits.
Robert?
Sienna asked uneasily.
What kind of monster?
Thonic, Langdon replied. The CH is silent. It means dwelling beneath the earth. Before Langdon could continue, the loud clunk of a deadbolt echoed across the baptistry. The tourist entrance had apparently just been unlocked from outside.
Grazie mille, said the man with the rash on his face.
A thousand thanks. The baptistry docent nodded nervously as he pocketed the $500 cash and glanced around to make sure nobody was watching.
Cinque minuti,
the docent reminded, discreetly swinging open the unbolted door just wide enough for the man with the rash to slip inside. The docent closed the door, sealing the man inside and blocking out all sound from outside. 5 minutes. Initially, the docent had refused to take pity on the man who claimed to have come all the way from America to pray at the baptistry of San Giovanni in hopes of curing his terrible skin disease. Eventually, though, he had been inspired to become sympathetic, aided no doubt by an offer of $500 for 5 minutes alone in the baptistry,
combined with the growing fear that this contagious-looking person would stand there beside him for the next 3 hours until the building opened. Now, as he moved stealthily into the octagonal sanctuary, the man felt his eyes drawn reflexively upward. Holy shit! The ceiling was like nothing he'd ever seen. A three-headed demon stared down directly at him, and he quickly lowered his gaze to the floor. The space appeared to be deserted. Where the hell are they? As the man scanned the room, his eyes fell on the main altar. It was a massive rectangular block of marble, set back in a niche, behind a barrier of stanchions and swags to keep spectators away. The altar appeared to be the only hiding place in the entire room. Moreover, one of the swags was swinging slightly, as if it had just been disturbed. Behind the altar, Langdon and Sienna crouched in silence. They had barely had time to collect the dirty towels and straighten the front cover before diving out of sight behind the main altar with the death mask carefully in tow. The plan was to hide here until the room filled up with tourists and then discreetly exit among the crowd. The baptistry's north door had definitely just been opened, at least for a moment, because Langdon had heard sounds emanating from the piazza. But then, just as abruptly, the door had been closed and all had gone quiet again. Now, back in the silence, Langdon heard a single set of footsteps moving across the stone floor. A docent? Checking the room before opening it to tourists later today? He had not had time to extinguish the spotlight over the baptismal font and wondered if the docent would notice. Apparently not. The footsteps were moving briskly in their direction, pausing just in front of the altar at the swag that Langdon and Sienna had just vaulted over. There was a long silence. "Robert, it's me," a man's voice said angrily. "I know you're back there. Get the hell out here and explain yourself." Chapter 59. There's no point in pretending I'm not here. Langdon motioned for Sienna to remain crouched safely out of sight, holding the Dante death mask, which he had resealed in the Ziploc bag. Then slowly, Langdon rose to his feet. Standing like a priest behind the altar of the baptistry, Langdon gazed out at his congregation of one. The stranger facing him had sandy brown hair, designer glasses, and a terrible rash on his face and neck. He scratched nervously at his irritated neck, his swollen eyes flashing daggers of confusion and anger. "You want to tell me what the hell you're doing, Robert?" he demanded, stepping over the swag and advancing toward Langdon. His accent was American. "Sure," Langdon replied politely. "But first, tell me who you are." The man stopped short, looking incredulous. "What did you say?" Langdon sensed something vaguely familiar in the man's eyes. His voice, too, maybe. "I've met him. Somehow, somewhere." Langdon repeated his question calmly. "Please tell me who you are and how I know you." The man threw up his hands in disbelief.
"Jonathan Ferris? World Health Organization? The guy who flew to Harvard University and picked you up?"
Langdon tried to process what he was hearing.
"Why haven't you called in?"
the man demanded, still scratching at his neck and cheeks, which looked red and blistered.
"And who the hell is the woman I saw you come in here with? Is she the one you're working for now?"
Sienna scrambled to her feet beside Langdon and immediately took charge.
"Dr. Ferris? I'm Sienna Brooks. I'm also a doctor. I work here in Florence. Professor Langdon was shot in the head last night. He has retrograde amnesia, and he doesn't know who you are or what happened to him over the last 2 days. I'm here because I'm helping him."
As Sienna's words echoed through the empty baptistry, the man cocked his head, puzzled, as if her meaning had not quite registered. After a dazed beat, he staggered back a step, steadying himself on one of the stanchions.
"Oh, my God," he stammered.
"That explains everything." Langdon watched the anger drain from the man's face.
"Robert," the newcomer whispered, "we thought you had—"
He shook his head as if trying to get the pieces to fall into place.
"We thought you had switched sides, that maybe they had paid you off or threatened you. We just didn't know."
I'm the only one he's spoken to, Sienna said. All he knows is he woke up last night in my hospital with people trying to kill him. Also, he's been having terrible visions. Dead bodies, plague victims, and some woman with silver hair and a serpent amulet telling him,
Elizabeth? The man blurted.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky. Robert, she's the person who recruited you to help us.
Well, if that's her, Sienna said, I hope you know that she's in trouble. We saw her trapped in the back of a van full of soldiers, and she looked like she'd been drugged or something.
The man nodded slowly, closing his eyes. His eyelids looked puffy and red.
What's wrong with your face? Sienna demanded.
He opened his eyes.
I'm sorry? Your skin. It looks like you contracted something. Are you ill?
The man looked taken aback, and while Sienna's question was certainly blunt to the point of rudeness, Langdon had wondered the same thing. Considering the number of plague references he'd encountered today, the sight of red, blistering skin was unsettling.
I'm fine, the man said. It was the damned hotel soap. I'm deathly allergic to soy, and most of these perfumed Italian soaps are soy-based. Stupid me for not checking.
Sienna heaved a sigh of relief, her shoulders relaxing now.
Thank God you didn't eat it. Contact dermatitis beats anaphylactic shock.
They shared an awkward laugh.
Tell me, Sienna ventured, does the name Bertrand Zobrist mean anything to you?
The man froze, looking as if he'd just come face to face with the three-headed devil.
We believe we just found a message from him, Sienna said. It points to some place in Venice. Does that make any sense to you?
The man's eyes were wild now.
Jesus, yes, absolutely. Where is it pointing?
Sienna drew a breath, clearly prepared to tell this man everything about the spiraling poem she and Langdon had just discovered on the mask. But Langdon instinctively placed a quieting hand on hers.
The man certainly appeared to be an ally, but after today's events, Langdon's gut told him to trust no one. Moreover, the man's tie rang a bell, and he sensed he might very well be the same man he had seen praying in the small Dante church earlier.
Was he following us?
How did you find us in here? Langdon demanded.
The man still looked puzzled that Langdon was not recalling things.
Robert, you called me last night to say you had set up a meeting with a museum director named Ignazio Busoni. Then you disappeared. You never called in. When I heard Ignazio Busoni had been found dead, I got worried. I've been over here looking for you all morning. I saw the police activity outside the Palazzo Vecchio, and while waiting to find out what happened, by chance I saw you crawling out of a tiny door with...
He glanced over at Sienna, apparently drawing a blank.
Sienna, she prompted. Brooks. I'm sorry, with Dr. Brooks. I followed you, hoping to learn what the hell you were doing.
I saw you in the Cerchi Church, praying, didn't I?
Yes. I was trying to figure out what you were doing, but it made no sense. You seemed to leave the church like a man on a mission, and so I followed you. When I saw you sneak into the baptistry, I decided it was time to confront you. I paid off the docent for a couple minutes alone in here.
Gutsy move, Langdon noted. If you thought I had turned on you. The man shook his head.
Something told me you would never do that. Professor Robert Langdon? I knew there had to be some other explanation, but amnesia?
Incredible. I never would have guessed. The man with the rash began scratching nervously again.
Listen, I was given only 5 minutes. We need to get out of here now. If I found you, then the people trying to kill you might find you too. There is a lot going on that you don't understand. We need to get to Venice, immediately. The trick will be getting out of Florence unseen. The people who have Dr. Sinsky, the ones chasing you, they have eyes everywhere.
He motioned toward the door. Langdon held his ground, finally feeling like he was about to get some answers. Who are the soldiers in black suits? Why are they trying to kill me?
Long story, the man said. I'll explain on the way.
Langdon frowned, not entirely liking this answer. He motioned to Sienna and ushered her off to one side, talking to her in hushed tones.
Do you trust him?
What do you think? Sienna looked at Langdon like he was crazy for asking.
What do I think? I think he's with the World Health Organization. I think he's our best bet for getting answers.
And the rash?
Sienna shrugged.
It's exactly what he says. Severe contact dermatitis.
And if it's not what he says, Langdon whispered, if it's something else?
Something else?
She gave him an incredulous look.
Robert, it's not the plague, if that's what you're asking. He's a doctor, for heaven's sake. If he had a deadly disease and knew he was contagious, he wouldn't be reckless enough to be out infecting the world.
What if he didn't realize he had the plague? Sienna pursed her lips, thinking a moment.
Then I'm afraid you and I are already screwed, along with everyone in the general area.
You know, your bedside manner could use some work.
Just being honest.
Sienna handed Langdon the Ziploc bag containing the death mask.
You can carry our little friend.
As the two returned to Dr. Ferris, they could see that he was just ending a quiet phone call.
I just called my driver, the man said. He'll meet us out in front by the...
Dr. Ferris stopped short, staring down at Langdon's hand and seeing for the first time the dead face of Dante Alighieri.
Christ!
Ferris said, recoiling.
What the hell is that?
Long story, Langdon replied. I'll explain on the way. Chapter 60 New York editor Jonas Faulkman awoke to the sound of his home office line ringing. He rolled over and checked the clock. 4:28 a.m. In the world of book publishing, late-night emergencies were as rare as overnight success. Unnerved, Faulkman slipped out of bed and hurried down the hall into his office. Hello? The voice on the line was a familiar deep baritone. Jonas, thank heaven you're home. It's Robert. I hope I didn't wake you.
Of course you woke me. It's 4 o'clock in the morning.
Sorry, I'm overseas.
They don't teach time zones at Harvard?
I'm in some trouble, Jonas, and I need a favor. Langdon's voice sounded tense. It involves your corporate NetJets card.
NetJets?
Faulkman gave an incredulous laugh.
Robert, we're in book publishing. We don't have access to private jets.
We both know you're lying, my friend. Faulkman sighed.
Okay, let me rephrase that. We don't have access to private jets for authors of tomes about religious history. If you want to write 50 Shades of Iconography, we can talk.
Jonas, whatever the flight costs, I'll pay you back. You have my word. Have I ever broken a promise to you?
Other than missing your last deadline by 3 years?
Nevertheless, Faulkman sensed the urgency in Langdon's tone.
Tell me what's going on. I'll try to help.
I don't have time to explain, but I really need you to do this for me. It's a matter of life and death. Faulkman had worked with Langdon long enough to be familiar with his wry sense of humor, but he heard no trace of joking in Langdon's anxious tone at that moment.
The man is dead serious.
Faulkman exhaled and made up his mind.
My finance manager is going to crucify me.
30 seconds later, Faulkman had written down the details of Langdon's specific flight request. Is everything okay? Langdon asked, apparently sensing his editor's hesitation and surprise over the details of the flight request.
Yeah, I just thought you were in the States, Faulkman said. I'm surprised to learn you're in Italy.
You and me both, Langdon said. Thanks again, Jonas. I'm heading for the airport now. NetJet's U.S. Operations Center is located in Columbus, Ohio, with a flight support team on call around the clock. Owner Services Representative Deb Keir had just received a call from a corporate fractional owner in New York.
One moment, sir,
she said, adjusting her headset and typing at her terminal.
Technically, that would be a NetJets Europe flight, but I can help you with it.
She quickly patched into the NetJets Europe system, centered in Paso de Arcos, Portugal, and checked the current positioning of their jets in and around Italy.
Okay, sir, she said. It looks like we have a Citation XL positioned in Monaco, which we could have routed to Florence in just under an hour. Would that be adequate for Mr. Langdon?
Let's hope so, the man from the publishing company replied, sounding exhausted and a bit annoyed.
We do appreciate it. Entirely our pleasure, Deb said. And Mr. Langdon would like to fly to Geneva?
Apparently. Deb kept typing.
All set, she finally said. Mr. Langdon is confirmed out of Tassignano FBO in Lucca, which is about 50 miles west of Florence. He will be departing at 11:30 a.m. local time.
Mr. Langdon needs to be at the FBO 10 minutes before wheels up. You've requested no ground transportation, no catering, and you've given me his passport information, so we're all set. Will there be anything else?
A new job? He said with a laugh. Thanks. You've been very helpful.
Our pleasure. Have a nice night.
Deb ended the call and turned back to her screen to complete the reservation. She entered Robert Langdon's passport information and was about to continue when her screen began flashing a red alert box. Deb read the message, her eyes widening.
This must be a mistake.
She tried entering Langdon's passport again. The blinking warning came up again. This same alert would have shown up on any airline computer in the world had Langdon tried to book a flight. Deb Keir stared a long moment in disbelief. She knew NetJets took customer privacy very seriously, and yet this alert trumped all of their corporate privacy regulations. Deb Keir immediately called the authorities. Agent Bruder snapped his mobile phone shut and began herding his men back into the vans.
Langdon's on the move, he announced. He's taking a private jet to Geneva. Wheels up in just under an hour out of Lucca FBO, 50 miles west. If we move, we can get there before he takes off.
At that same moment, a hired Fiat sedan was racing northward along the Via dei Panzani, leaving the Piazza del Duomo behind and making its way toward Florence's Santa Maria Novella train station. In the back seat, Langdon and Sienna huddled low, while Dr. Ferris sat in front with the driver. The reservation with NetJets had been Sienna's idea. With luck, it would provide enough misdirection to allow the three of them to pass safely through the Florence train station, which undoubtedly would otherwise have been packed with police. Fortunately, Venice was only 2 hours away by train, and domestic train travel required no passport. Langdon looked to Sienna, who seemed to be studying Dr. Ferris with concern. The man was in obvious pain, his breathing labored, as if it hurt every time he inhaled. I hope she's right about his ailment, Langdon thought, eyeing the man's rash and picturing all the germs floating around in the cramped little car. Even his fingertips looked like they were puffy and red. Langdon pushed the concern from his mind and looked out the window. As they approached the train station, they passed the Grand Hotel Baglioni, which often hosted events for an art conference Langdon attended every year. Seeing it, Langdon realized he was about to do something he had never before done in his life. I'm leaving Florence without visiting the David. With quiet apologies to Michelangelo, Langdon turned his eyes to the train station ahead, and his thoughts to Venice.
Chapter 61
Langdon's going to Geneva?
Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky felt increasingly ill as she rocked groggily in the back seat of the van, which was now racing out of Florence, heading west toward a private airfield outside of the city.
Geneva makes no sense, Sinsky told herself.
The only relevant connection to Geneva was that it was the site of the WHO's world headquarters.
Is Langdon looking for me there?
It seemed nonsensical, considering that Langdon knew Sinsky was here in Florence. Another thought now struck her.
My God, is Zobrist targeting Geneva?
Zobrist was a man who was attuned to symbolism, and creating a ground zero at the World Health Organization's headquarters admittedly had some elegance to it, considering his year-long battle with Sinsky. Then again, if Zobrist was looking for a receptive flashpoint for a plague, Geneva was a poor choice. Relative to other metropolises, the city was geographically isolated and was rather cold this time of year. Most plagues took root in overcrowded, warmer environments. Geneva was more than 1,000 feet above sea level and hardly a suitable place to start a pandemic.
No matter how much Zobrist despises me.
So the question remained, why was Langdon going there? The American professor's bizarre travel destination was yet another entry in the growing list of his inexplicable behaviors that began last night. And despite her best efforts, Sinsky was having a very hard time coming up with any rational explanation for them.
Whose side is he on?
Admittedly, Sinsky had known Langdon only a few days, but she was usually a good judge of character,
and she refused to believe that a man like Robert Langdon could be seduced with money.
And yet he broke contact with us last night.
Now he seemed to be running around like some kind of rogue operative.
Was he somehow persuaded to think that Zobrist's actions make some kind of twisted sense?
The thought gave her a chill.
No,
she assured herself.
I know his reputation too well. He's better than that.
Sinsky had first met Robert Langdon 4 nights before in the gutted hull of a retasked C-130 transport plane, which served as the World Health Organization's mobile coordination center. It had been just past 7 when the plane landed at Hanscom Field, less than 15 miles from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sinsky was not sure what to expect from the celebrated academic whom she had contacted by phone, but she was pleasantly surprised when he strode confidently up the gangplank into the rear of the plane and greeted her with a carefree smile.
Dr. Sinsky, I presume.
Langdon firmly shook her hand.
Professor, it's an honor to meet you.
The honor's mine. Thanks for all you do.
Langdon was a tall man, with urbane good looks and a deep voice. His clothing at the moment, Sinsky had to assume, was his classroom attire. A tweed jacket, khaki slacks, and loafers. Which made sense considering the man had essentially been scooped off his campus with no warning. He also looked younger and far more fit than she'd imagined, which only served to remind Elizabeth of her own age.
I could almost be his mother.
She gave him a tired smile.
Thank you for coming, Professor.
Langdon motioned to the humorless associate whom Sinsky had sent to collect him. Your friend here didn't give me much chance to reconsider.
Good. That's what I pay him for.
Nice amulet, Langdon said, eyeing her necklace. Lapis lazuli? Sinsky nodded and glanced down at her blue stone amulet, fashioned into the iconic symbol of a snake wrapped around a vertical rod.
The modern symbol for medicine. As I'm sure you know, it's called a caduceus.
Langdon glanced up suddenly as if there was something he wanted to say. She waited.
Yes?
Apparently thinking better of his impulse, he gave a polite smile and changed the subject. So why am I here? Elizabeth motioned to a makeshift conference area around a stainless steel table.
Please sit. I have something I need you to look at.
Langdon ambled toward the table, and Elizabeth noted that while the professor seemed intrigued by the prospect of a secret meeting, he did not appear at all unsettled by it.
Here is a man comfortable in his own skin.
She wondered if he would appear as relaxed once he found out why he had been brought here. Elizabeth got Langdon settled, and then, with no preamble, she presented the object she and her team had confiscated from a Florence safe deposit box less than 12 hours earlier. Langdon studied the small carved cylinder for a long moment before giving her a quick synopsis of what she already knew. The object was an ancient cylinder seal that could be used for printmaking. It bore a particularly gruesome image of a three-headed Satan along with a single word, Seligia. Seligia, Langdon said, is a Latin mnemonic for...
The 7 deadly sins, Elizabeth said. Yes, we looked it up.
Okay. Langdon sounded puzzled. Is there some reason you wanted me to look at this?
Actually, yes.
Sinsky took the cylinder back and began shaking it violently, the agitator ball rattling back and forth. Langdon looked puzzled by her action, but before he could ask what she was doing, the end of the cylinder began to glow, and she pointed it at a smooth patch of insulation on the wall of the gutted plane. Langdon let out a low whistle and moved toward the projected image.
Botticelli's map of hell, Langdon announced, based on Dante's Inferno, although I'm guessing you probably already know that.
Elizabeth nodded. She and her team had used the internet to identify the painting, which Sinsky had been surprised to learn was a Botticelli, a painter best known for his bright, idealized masterpieces, Birth of Venus and Springtime. Sinsky loved both of those works, despite the fact that they portrayed fertility and the creation of life, which only served to remind her of her own tragic inability to conceive, the lone significant regret in her otherwise very productive life.
I was hoping, Sinsky said,
that you could tell me about the symbolism hidden in this painting.
Langdon looked irritated for the first time all night. Is that why you called me in? I thought you said it was an emergency.
Humor me.
Langdon heaved a patient sigh. Dr. Sinsky, generally speaking, if you want to know about a specific painting, you should contact the museum that contains the original. In this case, that would be the Vatican's Bibliotheca Apostolica. The Vatican has a number of superb iconographers who...
The Vatican hates me.
Langdon gave her a startled look. You too? I thought I was the only one. She smiled sadly.
The WHO feels strongly that the widespread availability of contraception is one of the keys to global health, both to combat sexually transmitted diseases like AIDS, and also for general population control.
And the Vatican feels differently.
Quite. They have spent enormous amounts of energy and money indoctrinating third world countries into a belief in the evils of contraception.
Ah, yes, Langdon said with a knowing smile. Who better than a bunch of celibate male octogenarians to tell the world how to have sex? Sinsky was liking the professor more and more every second. She shook the cylinder to recharge it and then projected the image on the wall again.
Professor, take a closer look.
Langdon walked toward the image, studying it, still moving closer. Suddenly he stopped short. That's strange. It's been altered.
That didn't take him long. Yes, it has, and I want you to tell me what the alterations mean.
Langdon fell silent, scanning the entire image, pausing to take in the 10 letters that spelled Katravasa, and then the plague mask, and also the strange quote around the border about the eyes of death. Who did this? Langdon demanded. Where did it come from?
Actually, the less you know right now, the better. What I'm hoping is that you'll be able to analyze these alterations and tell us what they mean.
She motioned to a desk in the corner. Here? Right now? She nodded.
I know it's an imposition, but I can't stress enough how important this is to us.
She paused.
It could well be a matter of life and death.
Langdon studied her with concern. Deciphering this may take a while, but I suppose if it's that important to you...
Thank you,
Sinsky interjected before he could change his mind.
Is there anyone you need to call?
Langdon shook his head and told her he had been planning on a quiet weekend alone.
Perfect.
Sinsky got him settled at his desk with the projector, paper, pencil, and a laptop with a secure satellite connection. Langdon looked deeply puzzled about why the WHO would be interested in a modified painting by Botticelli, but he dutifully set to work. Dr. Sinsky imagined he might end up studying the image for hours with no breakthrough, and so she settled in to get some work of her own done. From time to time, she could hear him shaking the projector and scribbling on his notepad. Barely 10 minutes had passed when Langdon set down his pencil and announced, Cherka Trova. Sinsky glanced over.
What?
Cherka Trova, he repeated. Seek and ye shall find. That's what this code says. Sinsky hurried over and sat down close beside him, listening with fascination as Langdon explained how the levels of Dante's Inferno had been scrambled, and that, when they were replaced in their proper sequence, they spelled the Italian phrase Cerca Trova.
Seek and find? Sinsky wondered. That's this lunatic's message to me?
The phrase sounded like a direct challenge. The disturbing memory of the madman's final words to her during their meeting at the Council on Foreign Relations replayed in her mind.
Then it appears our dance has begun.
You just went white, Langdon said, studying her thoughtfully. I take it this is not the message you were hoping for? Sinsky gathered herself, straightening the amulet on her neck.
Not exactly. Tell me, do you believe this map of hell is suggesting I seek something?
Yes. Cerca Trova.
And does it suggest where I seek?
Langdon stroked his chin as other WHO staff began gathering around, looking eager for information. Not overtly, no. Although I've got a pretty good idea where you'll want to start.
Tell me,
Sinsky demanded, more forcefully than Langdon would have expected. Well? How do you feel about Florence, Italy?
Sinsky set her jaw, doing her best not to react. Her staff members, however, were less controlled. All of them exchanged startled glances. One grabbed a phone and placed a call. Another hurried through a door toward the front of the plane. Langdon looked bewildered. Was it something I said?
Absolutely, Sinsky thought. What makes you say Florence?
Cherkatrova, he replied, quickly recounting a long-standing mystery involving a Vasari fresco at the Palazzo Vecchio.
Florence it is, Sinsky thought,
having heard enough. Obviously, it could not be mere coincidence that her nemesis had jumped to his death not more than 3 blocks from the Palazzo Vecchio in Florence.
Professor, she said, when I showed you my amulet earlier and called it a caduceus, you paused, as if you wanted to say something. But then you hesitated and seemed to change your mind. What were you going to say?
Langdon shook his head. Nothing. It's foolish. Sometimes the professor in me can be a little overbearing. Sinsky stared into his eyes.
I ask because I need to know I can trust you. What were you going to say?
Langdon swallowed and cleared his throat. Not that it matters, but you said your amulet is the ancient symbol of medicine, which is correct. But when you called it a caduceus, you made a very common mistake. The caduceus has 2 snakes on the staff and wings at the top. Your amulet has a single snake and no wings. Your symbol is called
the Rod of Asclepius.
Langdon cocked his head in surprise. Yes, exactly.
I know. I was testing your truthfulness.
I'm sorry?
I was curious to know if you would tell me the truth, no matter how uncomfortable it might make me.
Sounds like I failed.
Don't do it again. Total honesty is the only way you and I will be able to work together on this.
Work together? Aren't we done here?
No, Professor. We're not done. I need you to come to Florence to help me find something.
Langdon stared in disbelief. Tonight?
I'm afraid so. I have yet to tell you about the truly critical nature of this situation.
Langdon shook his head. It doesn't matter what you tell me. I don't want to fly to Florence.
Neither do I, she said grimly. But unfortunately, our time is running out.